Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Here we are at the second Fashion Law Dinner Party, and more interdisciplinary conversation and scintillating perspectives between law, design, and heritage await us. If you were a guest at the first Fashion Law Dinner Party, you might have heard the word iconic. Patterns can be iconic, logos can be iconic, and more. But what does iconic actually mean? You might hear this word bandied about lately, on the red carpet, at the Grammys, even in your inbox. Just as we have archival drops, so we can have icons just a click away for our purchase. At least one dictionary defines iconic as, quote, very famous or popular, especially being considered to represent particular opinions or a particular time. Showing a relationship between the form of a sign, such as a word or a symbol, and its meaning, and of relating to or having the characteristics of an icon. In some circumstances, at least, we might think of iconic as indicating fame or celebrity. At the same time, the exact relationship that the word iconic signals seems, to a certain extent, left up to us. And in the fashion industry, left up to brands. So, why do brands create marketing campaigns around what they might term iconic fashion products? Does iconic mean the same thing for consumers as it does for brands? You might have seen, for example, a couple of years ago, the baguette was just everywhere and it was an iconic accessory. When we see the baguette and we call it iconic, do we mean the same thing that Fendi means when they call it iconic? And perhaps of most relevance for the market, and for lawyers, obviously, listening in, can the recognition that a product is iconic in marketing campaigns, fashion editorials, by the fashion media, and by consumers, increase intellectual property rights for brands in the product's design or even in a brand's own name? To start this conversation and this inquiry into the value of the word iconic, I thought I would turn to a brand that perhaps epitomizes an iconic moment in American fashion history. I'll give you a hint. Nothing will come between me and this quest with Prosecco in hand to discover what iconic means. Oh yes, you guessed it. We're heading to Calvin Klein. And not just to any department in Calvin Klein. We're heading to the archive to speak with Jessica Barber. Jessica, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. You are Calvin Klein's historian and senior archivist, and you have such a great behind the scenes perspective. And so to talk about the notion of iconic is just going to be really great. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
When we think of Calvin Klein, we think, you know, you want to know what comes between me and my Calvins, nothing, right? Brooke Shields, we all have that in our memory. What's a typical day in the life in your work, and how do you interact with other departments, especially, you know, when we think of what iconic designs or products are in the Calvin Klein universe?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't really have a typical day. And that's one reason why I like my job so much. One day I might be doing heavy research and writing up, you know, a deep dive report on some obscure subject in the brand's history. And the next day I might be dressing mannequins for a new archive exhibition that we're launching. And then the next week I might be in a ton of meetings. So it really varies a lot. And truly that's one of the great perks of my job, I think. But with the departments, you know, we are called upon for research quite often. Especially at the beginning stages, brainstorming stages of a particular project or an upcoming season. You know, our in-house designers are our biggest clients, as we call them. They might come to me and tell me what they're working on, and they will ask for all of the archive materials that we have on a particular topic. Or they might simply ask for my opinion based on my historical knowledge, since I'm so close to the brand history. You know, I live and breathe that every single day. So sort of the longer I've been in this position, I'm more and more like an in-house consultant for those departments within the company, especially designers and other teams that work directly with our products. People tend to ask for the same things at the same time, you know, whether it's internally, you know, the teams, that's good that they're all aligned, right? They're, you know, maybe the accessories team is working on something and, you know, the sportswear team is working on something. And so people do tend to ask for the same things at the same time. And again, that means that everyone's aligned. So that's great. But for us, you know, if we only have one of something, something, which is often the case, that can be tough. And then, of course, you know, we do deal with external institutions as well, like museums, for those purposes. And that, you know, gets us, you know, publicity value and things like that. So it is tough to balance. Sometimes we will actually retire garments to be used internally. So we do have a section that we call our hero products, that are, you know, for instance, like our earliest jeans, examples of like Calvin Klein jeans that we have. They're actually from 1976. And so they're from 2 years before we actually launched Calvin Klein jeans, but they did walk the runway. So those, you know, are very rare. I've actually never seen a pair that, you know, are not actually in our archive. So those we actually stopped loaning to anyone. So those internally and externally have been retired. You know, those are only, can only be consulted with, you know, in-house at the archive space. So it's tough. We do make calls like that when we decide, you know what, this has been used too much. Or, you know, you have to come to us if you want to see this piece. But it is a hard thing to deal with, because we are not a museum. We are a corporate archive. We are a working archive, as we like to say. And, you know, the purpose of the archive is to inherently make the company money. So how do you balance taking care of the objects, but also, you know, wanting to be really helpful and lending them to everyone who needs them?
Yeah. And so your, you know, moniker of hero brings me to this idea of iconic too, because mm-hmm. it seems from how you've described it that, you know, sometimes consumers in-house and museums, like, we're all aligned about the product we want. And that might be because it's, you know, important in the history and or what we would term iconic. So how do you think about the word iconic, given, you know, your work and your training? I'd especially be interested to know, you know, was iconic a word that was part of your training and education as an archivist or not?
Yeah, it's interesting. Something is truly iconic, I take it to mean that this item is the representative symbol of whatever it is we're talking about. If we're talking about movies, advertisements, whatever that category may be. And so that's what makes it worthy of our reverence, right? It's the pinnacle, it's the top example of that particular category. But I think more often, nowadays, it's simply being used to mean something that is noteworthy, or maybe even extremely well-known, which isn't the same thing. And I think that overuse of that term iconic has really watered it down, especially in the fashion industry. You know, if everything is iconic, then nothing is iconic. It's kind of like saying most unique. You can't compare two unique items, because being unlike is inherent in the definition of being unique. So that's what I think of when I think of iconic. And in my studies at FIT, we were actually advised not to use the word iconic. We had a list of words that we were sort of warned against using when writing about fashion. And, you know, this was back in 2009, 2010. So to me, this indicates that this term has been problematic for some time. You know, I think the concern from some of my FIT professors was that this word had been co-opted as a fashiony buzzword, and that, you know, we are trained historians, so we must be careful not to fall prey to these buzzy terms that are so often used or misused by fashion journalists. And of course, that's nothing against fashion journalists. Of course, it's the reality is that, you know, fashion historians have had a long fight to be well respected among our academic peers. So it's no surprise that we would be very hyper aware of the diction that we use when we're talking about fashion, because, you know, fashion was and still is scrutinized by some people as not being worthy of academic treatment. So when you're on the defensive already, you're going to be extremely conscious of the words that you use.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point that you make, because, you know, the fashion industry and, you know, the fashion preservation / right heritage aspect really are complementary and need each other, but they often have very different goals. And, you know, how you outline thinking about iconic is, you know, really indicative of that. I mean, is it the piece? You know, which it is for heritage professionals, or is it more just noteworthy, which kind of serves, you know, more commercial ends? And this also brings me, especially because you mentioned fashion journalists, and in my work, I do a lot of research on how the marketing language that's used, including the word iconic, affects the scope of legal rights. So, you know, thinking about how the language in one for one group of stakeholders affects the rights, and also the language that another group of stakeholders, you know, fashion lawyers or lawyers representing members of the fashion industry, you know, how that, what the cross-pollination is between those two, brings me to this idea too of social media. And I'm wondering, you know, what if you think, one thing I've noticed is it seems like copying has something to do with thinking about something as iconic. You know, I've been super struck. We're in this stage where we love everything archival. You know, I watched the Golden Globes last night, and, you know, Carey Mulligan's wearing this archival Schiaparelli dress, you know, from the 40s. I mean, before we, it seemed at least to, it seems to me, and I'm so, you know, so interested in your perspective on this, but it seems like we didn't, because we couldn't copy so easily, meaning we couldn't pull so easily from the archive, we couldn't point and shoot, right, and post it on social media, we didn't have this idea of seeing something multiple times. It was in our memory, but it wasn't there. So do you think that there's like a relationship between copying and iconic? And, you know, I mean, maybe this also has to do with marketing, but I'm thinking more of just like seeing something and thinking of it as iconic.
Yeah, I mean, social media has for sure contributed to this use or overuse of the word iconic. I think what you're saying is true. I don't think it should be true. I don't think that seeing a product over and over again should necessarily make it more iconic. But, you know, as you said, it does make it more notable. It makes it top of mind for consumers. And maybe that's enough these days, right? I think the only thing that can truly determine whether a product becomes iconic is time. You know, we need time and we need distance away from a product's introduction onto the market to truly see where it stands. You know, we need that 30,000 foot view. A true icon really stands the test of time. So we just can't tell what will or won't become iconic until some time passes. People like to say as soon as something happens, like, this is iconic. Well, you don't know. You don't know yet. It might be. It seems simple, but it's true. And this is also something we face in archiving because, you know, we have to determine what should be kept as a representative of the now without having the benefit of time away from now. Yeah. But we kind of have to put ourselves in the future looking back at today and consider what might be important. And that's a real challenge without the perspective of time. So
I think it's so right. I mean, I really agree with you. I mean, time is just the crucially important quotient in thinking about when something's iconic, but also in thinking about the brand story and narrative and what, you know, is iconic. So you need time for something to become iconic, but then also over time, you shape the brand narrative. So could you share a little bit about, you know, how do you think about time in your work at Calvin Klein? I mean, especially, you know, from the 80s to now, do you have a timeline that you use? Do you, you know, how does the thinking about hero products and iconic products intersect with the notion of time that you mentioned is so important?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I do have, you know, just rudimentary like outlines and, you know, historical timelines and things like that, that I've compiled over the years. And, you know, lots of reports, and presentations that I've done. I actually have a, you know, Calvin Klein a History 101 course that I give to, you know, new executives, you know, new associates. We call our employees associates. You know, I give them deep dive kind of like introduction to Calvin College, we sometimes call it. So, you know, I do have a lot of things at my disposal, but I'm always creating more. You know, and that's the great thing about getting a new research request is that every time I create something, I have that for reference, you know, for the future. And it's another interesting aspect of my job that not everybody experiences is that every time I create something, like, that's immediately like it's archived and it's like a snapshot in time. And I can always add to it. And I do try to keep these things updated, but it's a lot to keep up with. You know, we have a huge history. You know, we're over 50 years old. We were established in 1968. So it's a lot of history. And a lot of time to deal with.
I know you've put on a lot of exhibitions. So it would be great to hear a little bit about those.
Yeah. So a lot of our exhibitions, which for the most part are internal, because, you know, there are issues with, you know, using rights usages and things like that. You know, we haven't gone down the road of trying to do a large, you know, external exhibition for the public, you know, using it as an educational tool because we are a company and it's harder to get clearances for that type of thing. Because we do not own the rights to all of our imagery and things like that, which can be a surprise to some people. It's a very intricate topic, as you well know, images, rights, images, and things like
that. I think sometimes, especially with copyright, fear is a real animating factor for a lot mm-hmm. of archivists. I mean, even if you have an iconic product that, you know, you want to showcase and you want to show this really great fashion editorial, it was in, you know, in Vogue, for example, or W, if you can't get the permissions from the photographer mm-hmm. or from, you know, to show that image, you'll probably err on not showing it. And so then we get into questions of, well, if iconic really has to do with this copying, you know, as we talked about before, then, you know, what, how are you frustrating the recognition of iconicity, if you will, or of a product being an icon by not, you know, allowing by using rights to effectively halt people from using an image right. of the iconic product.
And also the fact that, I mean, these things can exist on anybody's Instagram feed. I mean, I could go and personally post an image of something. You know, social media has really changed the ball game. As a brand, you know that your images are floating out there and there might be whole Instagrams dedicated to the history of your brand, but you don't own that.
And, you know, that also gets us back to iconic because it, you know, is the purpose of the image on your personal Instagram to say, this is so iconic of Calvin Klein. And yet, you know, I mean, it's interesting to think about how the reproduction of images and the nature of something being iconic intersect, and yet the brand sometimes cannot take advantage of that right. iconic, except kind of by extension.
Right. Corporate archives are in an interesting space too, because we are at the intersection of education, but also commercial, you know, commercial use and for profit. So, you know, it's tough because we can have an argument for and against both. You know, we are trying to educate. We're either trying to educate our own internal employees or we're trying to educate the public about our brand. But inadvertently, of course, that's going to gain some for profit, you know, for the business. So it's tough. It's a tough space to be in for sure.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, like I always say too, commercial and non-commercial is a spectrum. It's not either or, you know, and exhibitions are a great example of that, especially corporate exhibitions. So I guess this takes me to another question I had, Jessica, which is, you know, as an archivist, what would you like lawyers, especially those practicing fashion law, who I hope are listening in, to know about, you know, your work and your role? I mean, is there any way, obviously we've mentioned the copyright and the images, but is there any other way that you feel like, you know, lawyers should appreciate your role more or what they should know about what you do and what your colleagues do in-house?
Yeah, so fashion archivists and lawyers have an interesting working relationship, some of which we already dove into. But, you know, I've worked closely with the in-house legal teams on various projects in my current role and at other companies as well. And it's interesting, at some brands, the archive may even ladder up to the legal team in terms of a reporting structure. This was the case at another U.S. fashion brand that I worked with before I came to Calvin. So in that situation, the archive was primarily used as a research tool to help prove claims of copyright or trademark infringement, which is an interesting use for the archive. And it was really their primary use. So I would say that if you're a fashion lawyer working with a brand and that brand does have an archive, the archivist or historian for that brand can be your best friend. It could be a huge help to you. You know, we have a ton of institutional knowledge, some of which might not even be written down. It's impossible to get every single thing that we know on paper and documented. But on the flip side, I would say just understand that a corporate archive scope of what they do and do not keep may be very narrow. So if you're looking for obscure legal documents from decades ago, or even things like contracts, this has come up a lot in my work, is, you know, do we have old contracts? And that's just not something that was within our scope. You know, you might be out of luck depending on the archiving strategy that's in place at that brand. And of course, they're going to be wildly different depending on where you are. So as archivists, we will try to help you find what we can, but don't be surprised if we don't have what you're looking for, I guess. You know, what we do find at the drop of a hat can feel like magic to some people, but I always like to remind people that we are archivists. We are not magicians. It looks like magic, but it's not.
You know, I hate to say this. Some people who, you know, are enthusiasts of American fashion might might take me to task, but you know, European fashion brands sometimes seem to have more iconic products mm-hmm. than American brands. Just going back to what you said so importantly about time, I think it's just a question of time. And so, you know, how do you think, or how do you see the notion of iconic products differing when you're in Europe or with your European colleagues, or even just in how you manage the Calvin Klein archive between Europe and the US, if there is a difference? You know, maybe there's not.
Yeah, I really don't see that much of a difference. You know, I mean, Calvin Klein is a huge global brand. So even though we have our roots in American fashion, I think, you know, it speaks to global audiences. And I think the current, you know, interest in iconic products, or, you know, even interest in general fashion archiving, is sort of irrespective of where a brand is based, at least in my experience. As you said, European fashion houses are, you know, they're older. So they've just simply had more time to decide, you know, what is considered to be iconic, or, you know, if they should be archiving their products in a strategic way. So I think for the US brands, it's really just a matter of playing catch up at this point. Mr. Klein was extremely ahead of his time when he decided to start archiving his products in the, you know, mid to late 1990s, because it just really wasn't a thought to most U.S. brands. But I do think this nostalgia for vintage and this celebration of, you know, iconic looks on social media has really contributed to our collective interest in all things archival fashion. If you follow the headlines, like, we really are in, like, just such a true heyday of archival fashion right now. It's really wonderful to see. You know, I mean, we've talked about Instagram, but there are so many amazing Instagram, like, throwback accounts documenting, you know, fashions of, like, TV shows like The Nanny and Sex and the City, or even ones documenting, like, tear sheets of old Delia's catalogs from the 90s, which are so great. So there's just so much archival fashion content out there right now.
Oh, I totally agree. I love it.
And it's definitely, like, a global audience in my experience. So I don't think that, from what I've seen, you know, our European offices, US offices, they all treat, you know, the product the same way, which is how we want it to be, because it even though there are regional differences, you know, we are a global brand.
Right. Another reason perhaps to use the moniker iconic, because it doesn't matter where you are. Right. It's, you know, the same no matter where it's placed, or, as you said earlier, quite correctly, the symbol.
Right.
In many instances. So I guess my last question would be, what do you see as the future for iconic products and hero products, both in your perspective as an archivist, but also for Calvin Klein? I mean, are there some hero products or iconic products we might not be aware of? How do you think, you know, the notion of iconic might evolve in the future?
I mean, when it comes to our archiving strategy and, you know, what we're trying to archive as, you know, the most important, we always just try to think of our brand DNA. And that's a very buzzwordy phrase that's been used in recent years by fashion insiders for a while now. So it's sort of similar to iconic, but, you know, we try to show, you know, what the brand stands for, you know, what our products communicate, you know, how, and how certain aspects of our history have been received by the public, and the impact that they've had on our culture as a whole is certainly part of that conversation. Like, you can't talk about the Brooke Shields commercials for Calvin Klein jeans without talking about their impact and their reception, and how they sort of shook the fashion and advertising industries. So those commercials are forever intertwined with the controversy that they cause. So you just can't discuss one without the other. And I think that's another way to tell if something is truly iconic. If you can't separate the product or the item or that thing from the impact that it had on its culture, then that's truly iconic. So really just think about that brand DNA and keep going back to that and say, you know, who are we? What do we stand for? What 20 years from now would somebody look at and say, oh, that was Calvin Klein? But it can be really subjective, and we're constantly living in the future and the past at the same time. So
that's so inspiring, because it also shows how important each one of us is in determining what's iconic, even in the Calvin Klein universe.
It's true. It's very true. I think about it all the time. It's like, if I were to disappear tomorrow, what would people say about the brand, you know, based on the work that I've done for the last 13 years. So that can be very inspiring, can also be very overwhelming to think about.
I would go for inspiring.
Yeah.
Speaking with Jessica expanded the definition of what I first thought of as iconic. And that expansion raised more questions for me about how the notion of iconic in a fashion archivist perspective might map on to how iconic is used under the law. Full disclosure, before speaking with Jessica, I'd already done some academic research on iconic and found the word in a number of U.S. trademark oppositions and filings, and early on in at least one case at the interface of trademark law and copyright law, a case that dealt with the design of the moon boot. The copyright case dealing with the moon boot's design was Italian and raised issues under Italian copyright law. So I thought, who better to explore iconic and IP law with than my colleague, the esteemed IP and fashion law expert and the founder of the IP Cat, Professor Eleonora Rosati. In your perspective as an IP attorney and scholar, and you know, you research and write in IP law, what do you see iconic as meaning, especially in the European context?
So in relation to the question that you've asked me, of course, the word iconic is connected to icon, which has a very specific religious and artistic meanings, especially from a European perspective. So leaving that aside, I think that indeed there is still a strong connection between this religious dimension of icon and the definition that you provide. So I would say that from a legal standpoint, yes, the word iconic is sometimes used loosely, and of course it doesn't have a specific legal meaning, but it connects to reputation, a certain aura, the embodiment of certain values, reflection of society, culture, cultural heritage, and these are all things that, as you know better than myself, find a reflection and some specific protection in the law. And this spans cultural heritage law, trademark protection, and I would say also the interplay between intellectual property and the public domain at large, and the attempts that have been made and are routinely made to indeed keep protecting things that are perceived to be not only important to certain stakeholders, certain group or company, but to a broader societal group. And here we have also the discussion around copyright, trademarks, designs, and indeed how it is possible to supplement the limited lifespan of an IP right like copyright through different means, for example, through trademark registrations. So to conclude, iconic is a term that does not have really a specific legal significance, but if we break down the meaning and we look indeed at the roots of this word, we find that the law does indeed reserve a specific space for objects that we consider iconic.
And certainly, you know, fashion lawyers listening in, and probably even, you know, young designers might think, oh, yes, I've heard before of this interplay between trademark and copyright. But of course, you know, cases are also really a good way to break down the impact that a word like iconic can have, as you say. You know, it's not a legally defined word, but certainly there are moments when it has a legal impact. One of the cases for me that is always, you know, the foundation of, you know, the place from which I depart when I think of iconic and this interplay is, of course, the moon boots case. Mm-hmm. And I know you've thought about that case and you've written about it too on the IP Cat blog. Could you, you know, tell us a little bit about that case and how it, especially in Europe, really embodies this, you know, trademark and copyright interface?
The history of moon boots, the design was inspired by the boots of indeed the astronauts landing on the moon. Since then, they've become perhaps the best known après-ski boots that have been introduced on the market. And when it comes to something like that, at the outset, now if we think in abstract terms, the natural form of IP protection will be through a design right or design patent, to use indeed the US language. But in Europe, the maximum protection that you can get this way is 25 years. So you understand that for something that is commercially very successful, it is not a very long time. So here indeed we had the Technica, that is the owner of the moon boots, trying to secure protection in different ways, and in particular through copyright claims and trademark registrations. And insofar as copyright is concerned, it is interesting that in Italy, where these cases were litigated, copyright protection of the moon boots was acknowledged, but the Italian legal standard for works of applied art, as the moon boots are, has been traditionally that originality alone will not be enough, and that you will need something more, in particular a recognition of artistic value of the object attended. And the fact that the Italian courts on two occasions and different courts found that this artistic value was there made the moon boots recognizable and therefore protectable under copyright law. A different fate was reserved instead under trademark law, because indeed moon boots were registered as a 3D mark at the new level. And indeed, what happens when there are these 3D marks is that you might get to the point of getting the registration certificate, but it is always unclear how strong and resistant this registration is going to be. And it happens invariably that when you try indeed to enforce these types of registrations, the first move of the defendant would be to question the very validity of these registrations. And it is indeed what happened with the moon boots 3D mark. And this challenge was successful because indeed the registration was narrowed down by removing the most meaningful products for this type of registration, in particular footwear. So the argument was that this shape would not possess distinctiveness, in particular inherent distinctiveness, because it would not be a sufficient departure from the norms of the sector, which is instead required under EU law. So what we have here, it is a product that on the one hand is considered artistic enough to be a copyright work. On the other hand, is considered not to function as an indicator of origin, at least for certain types of goods. So a result that I think is difficult to comprehend, but at the same time, it is the exact reverse of what has happened to the Longchamp Le Pliage bag. I would say that that is an iconic bag. We see it everywhere. It is a very successful product. And once again, the 3D marks this time were found to be valid and enforceable, but the copyright was refused, at least by the Milan Court of First Instance. And this in contradiction to decisions that were rendered in other countries in Europe. So sometimes we have legal standards that we need to apply, but how they are applied is very much a matter of evidence and also the sensitivity of courts and competent authorities.
The iconic, you know, when we think about it in the trademark sense, is meant to represent how consumers, when they see a design, associate that design with the origin, with the producer, with the person who's standing behind, you know, we would say in the US, the product. Whereas iconic in copyright law, at least as we've talked about it in the Italian sense, where this, as you said, artistic value is needed in addition to creative character, it's something that is connected more to, you know, we might even say cultural heritage evidence, like was the moon boot in an exhibit? And yet, you know, you would think that because the word iconic is used, it means similar things, but it doesn't. And so there's a real dissonance there. Of course, you know, we're talking here about distinctiveness compared to artistic value, but there are also other parts of trademark law that are relevant to iconic. For example, as those listening in, you know, will probably know, a mark needs to be non-functional as well as have distinctiveness. And I know that you recently highlighted a case also involving, we might say, another iconic product, the Vespa in Italy, where we might say substantial value in the EU, or what we would call aesthetic functionality in the United States, was an issue with the term iconic. So could you tell us a little bit about that case too?
Of course, as you all pointed out, it is a case about the well-known Vespa, but it is a case that will have, I think, a broad repercussions also in the fashion sector. So in essence, the Vespa has been around for decades, and I would say it has become a symbol of Italy together with other things. But when we think about this country, the Vespa comes to mind. And what happened in essence was that there was a discussion as to what extent the fact that it is considered to possess artistic value, to be protected by copyright, might also lead to a finding of aesthetic functionality or substantial value. So under EU law, the test is that a signs that consist exclusively of a shape or other characteristic that confer substantial value cannot be registered. And it is clear that this meaning of substantial value is very elusive, and the case law has not yet clarified what that means, how it is to be measured, whose perspective is to be taken into account. So I would say that it is still surrounded by considerable obscurity, and indeed in the context of the 2015 EU trademark reform, there were people who advocated for its abolition, given that it is so difficult to comprehend and apply satisfactorily. So in essence, what happened is that Piaggio, which is the owner of Vespa, has been in litigation for years with a Chinese manufacturer of lookalike products, and in particular a moped that is called, quite tellingly, Ves.
Wow, so different.
It's a Ves, not a Vespa, but still. And the litigation was conducted at all levels, and in the end there was an appeal to the Italian Supreme Court on points of interpretation of the law, because this is not a court on the merits. And the defendant, this Chinese company, was no longer making an argument that the 3D Vespa mark would be lacking distinctiveness. This matter has been litigated also at the EU level. But it made an argument that this shape would be a substantial value conferring one. And importantly, if that is the case, it doesn't matter that the shape is distinctive. It cannot be registered. So it is an absolute prohibition to registration. And in essence, the Italian Supreme Court considered to what extent the fact that there is an artistic value means that this cannot be a trademark. And it came, in my opinion, to the very odd conclusion that something that is deemed to possess artistic value by default is also a substantial value conferring a type of object and therefore cannot be a trademark. Why do I think that this is inappropriate as an approach? Because, yes, the Vespa was not born iconic. For sure, it has some inherent attractiveness, etc. But I would say it has been through the efforts made by the owner to turn it into an iconic product, no? And therefore also to acquire this artistic value. So the question now is, should one be punished for doing a great job at putting on the market and creating an impression of a product that means more than just an object? I would say that that is incorrect. And indeed, and this brings me back to the fashion world. If we read the opinions of Advocate General Spooner in the Louboutin case concerning indeed whether the iconic red sole could be a trademark, he said, to put it very simply, that you need to ask yourself, why do you like Louboutins? Do you like them because they are objectively beautiful or because they are Louboutins? Now, I ask this question every time I teach substantial value to different courses of students. And I have to tell you that of all the students that I've asked, law students, business students, non-art students, so no matter the background, there has not been a single one who has told me I like it because they're objectively beautiful. They've all said I like it because they're Louboutins. So if that is the answer, then the Advocate General said the substantial value ground does not apply because it is not inherently beautiful. It is something that becomes attractive thanks to the efforts and the reputation the brand owner has built. So if this approach is, as I think, correct, then saying that something iconic cannot be a trademark, I think conflates different issues and ends up punishing those who have done all their best to set themselves apart from the competition.
So yes. That was a mistake. Yeah, no, and that's a fascinating case also, because in some ways it also sets up, you know, a strong battle also in within trademark doctrine, because, you know, on the one hand, it seems as though, well, if you go over to functionality, the fact that you're iconic, you know, can hurt you. If you're in distinctiveness, iconic might help you. And, you know, you also into that have in the mix, you know, I think especially from in U.S. law, this idea of genericness, which I see very much at play both before something is deemed iconic and then afterwards. And maybe that's also what is interesting about iconic and functionality here in the Vespa case, because it's almost as though you made, I mean, now thinking from the Vespa perspective, you made something so iconic, so, you know, recognizable and important, even if it brings along you as a brand with everything that comes with it, made in Italy, this notion of Roman holiday, zipping around as a Vespa, you know, all of those things, plus the fact that I, as a consumer, identify you, you've made that so important that you lose it. So you've worked up for something that is iconic, but now it's so iconic to us that it's almost as though it needs to belong to everyone, or at least to competitors. Now, on the other hand, you know, so in some ways it becomes, now we're in functionality right now, but in some ways it becomes, you know, generic, if you want to call it that, if you want to, you know, ascribe that other term. Now, when, you know, you think about designs like the baguette bag, for example, Effendi's, you have these designs which certainly are in the public domain. They don't have trademark rights, and then they're so ubiquitous. But then we see these brands, and this is where, you know, acquired distinctiveness comes in. We see these brands doing these marketing bonanzas so that consumers will identify the design, even if it's so functional, with, you know, Fendi as the producer, or the other brand, right, whoever's doing this marketing bonanza, as the producer, as the origin. And so it really seems like you have this, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, possibly battle in trademark doctrine itself. I mean, does that seem to be the case to you? And if it is, how are we, you know, how should brands kind of think about their deploying of the word iconic?
No, I agree with you that indeed it seems that one is caught between a rock and art place, and more than that, there is no clear-cut guidance on anything. Just to give you an example, you know, that is unrelated to what we are discussing. Now, a recent trend at the EU level is for models to register their own faces as trademarks. So that is a trend, but what we are seeing is that some applications go through and some do not. The most recent one is Dotson Cross, the Dutch model. I'm sure I mispronounced their name, so apologies. But essentially, her application did fail, and the conclusion was that it doesn't matter how iconic or famous you are, that is not a trademark. So, but then in other instances, completely unknown models having their face registered. So it is completely inconsistent as an approach. And speaking indeed about what you've raised, this distinctiveness that can be inherent or acquired, etc. So if we think inherent distinctiveness, would you say that the shape of the Dior saddle bag is different from the baguette, or you think that it is quite a commonplace type of shape?
So, see, I would call that iconic because it is a saddle, and it's not every day that you see the shape of a saddle. as a bag. So I would call that much more iconic than, and also just to say, and I think this also is relevant to your question, you know, why, when I think of why it's iconic, this dichotomy, this example you set up between the Dior saddlebag and the Fendi baguette bag is also very, very interesting, because when I think of the Dior saddlebag as being iconic, I think of the saddle, the shape, it's different. But when I think of the baguette bag, and maybe also this is because, you know, I've researched the baguette bag more than the Dior saddlebag, full disclosure. But I mean, I think of all these other things that have to do with the baguette bag universe, like Sex in the City and the robbery in the episode, you know, or so why, you know, you think, I know, so where you see my film of TV proclivities right now, but I mean, but you know, you, why you think of something iconic is also important. Is it just the product, or is it this whole like universe that's been created around the product too? But anyway, long answer to your question. So to go back, yes, to the Dior saddlebag, is it iconic or not?
I think it is, and it is also very unusual as a shape. Yet, so far at the EU level, it has been refused the trademark registration. And if one reads the decision, I think is really puzzling, because the evidence that is retrieved suggests that there are indeed other saddle shaped bags in the market, so it doesn't inherently function as such. But sorry, if there are saddle-shaped bags, it's because there is the Dior saddle. It is a very unusual shape. So I find that this was wrongly decided. And if we speak instead about acquired distinctiveness, the latest data that actually was communicated just a few days ago suggests that proving acquired distinctiveness is not easy at all, and in the EU, most of these claims do fail. So if there was a refusal based on lack of inherent distinctiveness, you can go ahead and try acquired distinctiveness, but most of the time you will not succeed. So it is a false hope that is given, because the statistics suggest that it is not really easy to overcome an objection based on lack of distinctiveness. And indeed, from the fashion sector, we have the clear-cut example of the Damier Azure by LVMH. So that was a complex legal case in which, in the end, there was a possibility for LVMH to prove acquired distinctiveness. But they were not able to provide evidence that was considered strong enough to cover a substantial part of the European Union. So it is true that you don't need to provide evidence for all the 27 member states, but the fact that not even a giant like LVMH is able to overcome this hurdle, to me, suggests that things are not going to be easier for smaller brands and the likes.
There are, you know, extra legal benefits to marketing bonanzas that don't have to do with, you know, acquiring trademark rights and, you know, in a design of a bag, but that certainly still doesn't answer the question of, well, how do you gain those rights? You know, I mean, it doesn't really give you, as we were talking about with clear-cut reasoning, it doesn't give you a clear-cut path or a clear way. So that's also very interesting. From the U.S. perspective, you know, Jeannie Frommer has written a really interesting article against secondary meaning, really showing also how sometimes, you know, brands tend to, if I may, like, game the system with, you know, just the amount of money they're spending too. We're talking a lot about iconic, of course, in the tangible space. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk into a store, you pick up a bag, it's iconic, you wear it. But of course, we are dealing now with the specter of iconic products in the virtual space. So, you know, Valentino, for example, is dressing, you know, your Bitmoji and all these other, you know, things. So do you think that the word iconic might have, you know, similar, well, we've talked about how it's not a clear cut, you know, solution for brands, but do you think that iconic will still be used for trademarks in the virtual space, will perhaps still have this confused cross-cutting mm-hmm. result, or might it be, you know, relatively more clear as an avenue to either gain trademark rights or even, you know, frankly, copyright at this point, although there we'd be thinking about another category and not, you know, tangible I mean, designs, industrial designs of tangible goods.
But I would say that the picture is still rather blurry, and we have contrasting signals that are being sent, because on the one hand, we have, you know, now iconic cases, like, for example, the Meta Birkin one, in which Hermès was able indeed to successfully enforce its trademark rights in a virtual context. But on the other hand, we have situations like Burberry trying to register the iconic pattern for indeed downloadable virtual goods, including digital clothing, and so far not succeeding in this respect at the EU level. So I would say that the picture is still in need of stabilization, but what seems sure is that as there is inconsistency of approaches in the analog world, the same is likely to be true in the virtual one too.
Great. Well, the good news is more work for lawyers, I guess, is the takeaway. It's the takeaway there, and more things to write about, so that's good. Well, I mean, I should say that's good, I guess, from a personal perspective, but not maybe from a holistic one. So last question, because it relates to iconic, but it's a bit, you know, I mean, it's related to IP too, but it's a bit further afield. There's been a lot of talk about this, you know, new eco-design regulation for sustainable products and how it might, you know, obviously support more circular design and sustainability initiatives. But I'm wondering, do you think, and this is an open question I have, I'm really curious to see this. Do you think that because, you know, brands might have to use more recycled materials, that it will affect iconic products in the sense that, you know, it will make some iconic products less so, or it will make them more so? I mean, I think of, you know, the example I think of always is Ferragamo's rainbow sandal and how a few years ago they created this sustainable crochet rainbow sandal for their sustainable thinking exhibition. But, you know, there, the iconic nature of the design was still there, but it was in different materials. So I'm just wondering, in your perspective and experience, how do you think, you know, this eco design and iconic might overlap?
You know, what you're flagging is indeed something that is true. There are things that are beautiful, but they will no longer be, you know, politically correct even to wear them or say that they are beautiful. So now we'll not name names, but I think that everyone who's listening can think of examples of things that our grandmothers, our mothers did wear. They are beautiful, but today you could not really leave the house with something like that.
Fur. That's number one.
But at the same time, I mean, there are for sure changes in consumer sensitivity. So things that might have been considered bad looking a few years ago, now they're completely acceptable. And this makes me think about two things. The first one is, for example, what has happened during COVID. No? Of course, their actual retail stores were closed. And there has been always a sense of suspicion for luxury brands to sell online, you know, because this has always been considered as a cheapening the aura of luxury. But the evidence, for example, from the sale on the internet of luxury watches is encouraging, because it does demonstrate that the consumers did not think that they were getting a lesser experience by buying, for example, a Rolex on the internet instead of a retail store. At the same time, the latest data from indeed the virtual marketplaces, online marketplaces, now that everything has reopened and COVID thankfully seems to be something that is falling into oblivion, suggests that people like the actual retail experience. So a crisis is undergoing in this sense. So all this to say what? That things that change by their nature at the beginning can face some resistance, but then the reaction might be unexpectedly positive. So this might be also the case for these iconic designs using different materials. At the same time, I mean, I think that there will be also greater room for being a bit careful and cautious that things that look good and feel like that you are doing the right thing might actually be quite harmful to indeed the environment or something like that. Let me give a, you know, very specific example that is fur related. I seen that this winter it has become, you know, quite popular. Also looking at social media like TikTok, etc., Slavic girl looks, Russian girl look, and of course that is that entail a fur because of this, you know, idea of how life is lived in these very cold weathers, no? And so we have a lot of fake furs being sold by the likes of Zara, H&M. There are these viral fur coats, etc. But if we look at the environmental impact of something that is essentially plastic, it's probably greater than, for example, buying a vintage second-hand actual fur. So what I'm saying is not that I am endorsing fur making and fur sales, but I would say that with these considerations and sensitivity, that is, of course, very well placed and absolutely necessary towards respecting the environment and having greater sustainability, there will be also room for mistaking what is actually at issue. So I would say greater room for greenwashing claims, undue advertising messages, misleading consumers, etc. So I see that there will be more need for vigilance also from this point of view to ensure that the goals of these laudable initiatives are actually achieved in the end.
Yeah, so I would say all the more reason to wear our iconic furs that have been passed down to us and to not give in and buy the faux fur at Zara. So, and to look iconic ourselves in the Scandinavian girl look. So, so much inspiration here, Eleonora. Thank you so much. This has been so much fun. So thank you.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And of course, I do not endorse fur.
Yes, of course, there's the disclaimer. Yes. Well, now that this fashion law dinner party is over, I'll finish my espresso and dessert, put my vintage fur on, and as I take a necessary after-dinner walk, think about our question. What makes an iconic product? Celebrity might, fame, noteworthiness. And to be noteworthy or famous as a product, it seems, especially from my conversation with Jessica, that copying helps, but so does time. At the same time, pun intended, it also seems like we may be using iconic in a ubiquitous way. Iconic should stand in for a pinnacle, as the representation. And yet, so often, the way the word iconic is used, it doesn't. It means something less. Well-known or famous, not the one unique thing. Complicating matters is that what makes an iconic product in a brand universe might not make a product iconic in the legal universe. In some jurisdictions, being iconic might not matter at all for copyright protection, while in others, as I discussed with Eleonora, artistic value and iconic might overlap. In trademark law, iconic stature may or may not equal the distinctiveness a design or other logo or symbol needs to, in fact, be a mark under the law. In fact, iconic might mean a design is not able to be registered as a trademark or able to be considered a trademark at all. But that's just in our physical, tangible world. As Eleonora and I touched upon, what about the digital universe or the metaverse? What happens when fashion, its design and heritage, and the rights that apply to fashion go digital? That's the topic of our next Fashion Law Dinner Party. I hope you'll join me as I speak with the architect of the Fashion Calendar Research Database, Natalie Nudell, with the celebrated IP scholar Mark McKenna, and with Elena Varese at DLA Piper in Milan about the future of digital fashion and its heritage.